This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. So shares of Quest Diagnostics, they're up roughly 20%, almost 20% this year. Company 2 out with some news today about completion of what it is calling a next-generation lab facility in my own home state of New Jersey, which is where the company is based. Here to tell us more about the business outlook is Steve Rutkowski. He's chairman, president, and CEO of Quest Diagnostics. He joins us on the phone from Secaucus, New Jersey. Hey, Steve, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
I'm doing well, Carol. Thanks for having us.
Well, it's great to have you here. Let's talk a little bit about business before we get into your new facility. You did boost your 2021 outlook on the top and bottom lines because of stronger testing volumes, Delta increasing testing demand. That's certainly one of the big factors. How is business today? Are you starting to see that trail off as we see us kind of get maybe a little bit more control of the Delta variant?
Yeah, so Carol, as we entered 21, we expected that our COVID volumes would come down in the first half. And what we did see was exactly that. But then in the month of June, we started to see it pick up in response to the Delta variant. And we updated our expectation for the back half for COVID. And we said at the low end of our outlook that we would expect about 40,000 tests per day in the back half of 21.
Is that a lot? Give us some perspective. I have no idea.
Yeah.
You guys are huge and massive.
Give an idea of scale. Back in the early days of 21, we're doing about 120,000 to 150,000 tests per day. So we were down considerably coming out of the second quarter, down to about 35,000 to 40,000 tests per day, and that number has come up. And we've been approaching 80 to 100,000 tests per day through some portion of the third quarter. But we do expect, as we start to see the infection rates coming down, and typically our testing volumes follow infection rates, that will slow somewhat in the back half of the second half. So we're seeing higher than expected volumes as we enter the year for COVID. And we're right in the middle of it in the third quarter. We will announce earnings in October, and we do expect that number will come down at the back half to give us that low end of the outlook of 40,000 tests per day.
Steve, where does that number stabilize? Where is that number a year from now?
Well, it's a good question because we're watching, you know, the Delta variant and also its relationship to the vaccines, relationship to natural immunity, what's happening elsewhere in the world. And when we had our investor day in the spring, what we said is that, yes, we believe COVID will slow down this year, but it's not going away. We're going to be seeing this in 22 and beyond. We believe it's going to become more flu-like, and that it's going to be, you know, a portion of our testing portfolio going forward. And we do believe it's for our diagnostic testing to determine whether you have COVID or not. And we run primarily the PCR test, which is the gold standard. But we'll also include the whole portfolio that we have brought out and we'll continue to build on around serology testing, which tests for the antibodies to determine whether the vaccine is working or whether you have immunity in some form and what's happened to that immunity over time.
Hey, Steve, you have an amazing amount of data given what you do. You understand where hotspots are emerging. You understand which areas that you have testing facilities in or you get specimens from are seeing a rise in cases. What do you know before regulators know? What do you know before public health officials know? And how do you communicate what you find out to them?
Yeah, so we have a reporting requirement for all infectious diseases that we had in place before COVID, and whether it's HIV or hepatitis B or C, we had to report that data to public health officials, and that's around the country in every state. And actually, we report into about 800 different locations throughout the country all our results. So when we have a positive PCR test for COVID, we provide that information to public health officials. So they pretty much have that information at the same time that we're seeing and once we result it, because we report it on a daily basis to these reporting entities.
So tell us about this new testing facility in New Jersey, my home state of New Jersey. What can you tell us about it? And I'm curious about, it was in the works, from what I understand, ahead of COVID, but it sounds like you picked up, ramped up getting it done. What does it mean in terms of your productivity, ability to process diagnostic testing, and what does it mean ultimately for top and bottom lines?
Yeah, we're excited about it, Kara. We have been on a march to continuously improve our business, and we've been, as a company, working on two strategies. One is to continue to build programs that support accelerating growth, and that's underpinned with a belief that our operations need to continue to get stronger, and we call that operational excellence. And as part of that, we've been striving for 3% productivity improvement per year. And our view on productivity improvement, it does not come without improvement in quality and service performance. And so as part of that program, we actually invested in the new facility in Clifton, New Jersey. It affords us an opportunity to consolidate a number of our smaller facilities into one larger facility. It also allows us to harmonize our processes and put in common systems across the company.
Right.
And it also allows us to put in new automation.
Right.
And testing capacity.
Hey, Steve, you were telling us about this new next generation lab facility. You guys use the word next generation. What makes it next generation?
Yeah, Carol, we're excited about it in many different ways. First of all, it's one of our largest facilities in the country. It's going to serve about seven states. It will serve about 40 million people. It'll give us capacity of about 300,000 tests per day. So it's big. And secondly is because of the automation and the ability for us to do more integrated testing, it's going to allow us to even improve the quality and the service performance and productivity that we have today. So we're quite excited about it coming online. We invested about $250 million in this project, and actually we started a little bit of the construction before the pandemic, but it was just remarkable how we completed it despite the pandemic, and it's up and running today. So we're very proud of that.
Hey, how much of it, or increasingly is it, help me out here, I'm not an expert on this, you are, how much is automated? Is all of it automated?
Not entirely. If you go into a lab environment, you still see a lot of people and a lot of manual labor. But what's happened over time, Carol, is some processes have been automated by some of our suppliers. We actually have over 200 suppliers that provide equipment and capabilities into this laboratory. So they do some consolidation and automation. And then we bring together some of those work cells, because you're doing multiple tests on a common specimen. So when you get inside of a laboratory, you have a common collection area that you sort out those specimens, and then you put those in each of their work cells. Each of those work cells have become more automated over time. Mm-hmm. But I'll share with you, even though we're very proud of what we've done here, there's more of that work we believe we can do going forward.
Employees, are you hiring more? Are you finding the employees you need?
We're proud to be hiring about 1,000 people. Some of these people came from our existing facilities. We had a large facility in Teterboro that we consolidated over to Clifton. So we're happy that those people will join us in Clifton, but we're also bringing in some more people as well. So about 1,000 people.
Hey, Steve, I'm wondering about home testing. There's been a big movement during the pandemic when it comes to home diagnostic testing. And indeed, the Biden administration said recently it would spend $1 billion to boost the supply of rapid COVID tests. I'm wondering how you think about the rise in home testing that we've seen, not just for COVID, but for other ailments too.
Yeah, we've been in the home testing business before the pandemic. We actually developed and implemented a program called Quest Direct back about 3 years ago, where you offer through our direct platform the capability for a consumer to buy laboratory testing. And some of this could be your standard cholesterol test. We call it a lipid panel, or testing for diabetes. The standard test there will be glucose or hemoglobin A1C. And consumers can buy this directly online, and we will then guide them through the process of getting their blood collected, and then we resulted in a smart app we call MyQuest. And what we found before the pandemic, there was a market, but during the pandemic, the market has grown considerably. And that's for the what we call our base business testing. But on top of this platform, we incorporated what we're doing around COVID as well. So the ability for people to get a PCR test or a serology test is on this direct platform as well. And with COVID, the gold standard is what we have been discussing, which is referred to as PCR.
Right.
But we also are providing antigen testing, which mm-hmm. is the at-home capability where you can do the specimen collection yourself, and you can actually do some of the reporting it through some of the applications that are provided. And we do believe there is a place for those antigen tests in the management of COVID going forward. And we provide those to consumers as well as to employers.
Hey, Steve, we've got to run, but really appreciate checking in with you about the new facility and the outlook for your business. Steve Ruskowski, CEO over at Quest Diagnostics, on the phone in Secaucus. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovic, in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Well, Stephen Miller, a fixture in the Trump administration, known for being the architect of then-President Donald Trump's anti-immigration policies, is now bringing that crusade to the court. So let's get more on what he's doing. It's a story to be in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week out later this week, online and on the Bloomberg. Let's bring in Bloomberg Business Week editor Jill Weber in our Interactive Brokers studio, along with Eric Larson, who is U.S. legal reporter at Bloomberg News. He's on the phone in Brooklyn. Stephen Miller.
I thought this was really interesting because it's sort of like the right's answer for ACLU. And, you know, the central question that I wanted to raise with Eric is like, is this for real? Is the legal community looking at these cases as something that has, you know, real legal merit? Or is this more of a way of, you know, drumming up support for Trump in a fundraising sort of sense?
Well, to be honest, it seems like it could be a little bit of both. That's certainly the views that I got from some of the folks that I spoke with when writing this story. You know, it's a brand new group. You know, it just started in April, and already, you know, there's these comparisons to the ACLU, which has been around, you know, forever, and saying that it's this right answer to the ACLU, and they do seem to be taking that pretty seriously. They, you know, like you mentioned, they filed some lawsuits against the Biden administration right off the bat. You know, they have several cases pending, actually, and they actually got a little bit of traction in a couple of the cases where injunctions were requested were granted. And they're filing a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. You can see it all up on their website. You know, it's pretty nonstop. And of course, they're making regular television appearances on Fox News and Newsmax and OAN. So they're definitely drumming up a lot of support.
Hey, Eric, take a step back and remind people who Stephen Miller is. I mean, people who follow politics closely remember him, but take us back to what he did during the Trump administration, what he was responsible for.
Sure. So Stephen Miller, he's 36 years old, and during Trump's term, he was a speechwriter. He was a senior White House aide, and I think a lot of people hadn't heard of him before. And all of a sudden, he kind of had this fairly prominent behind-the-scenes job. And as then President Trump was coming out with some of his pretty hardline immigration policies, folks started to backtrack and look where these were coming from, and they seemed to be coming from this guy named Stephen Miller. So he sort of has a long history of being anti-immigration, very America First, you know, hence the name of this organization, America First Legal. And he was the architect of, for example, the Muslim ban that was so contentious and so divisive during the start of Trump's presidency, and also the child family separation policies and things like that. So his fingerprints were on a lot of that.
So his efforts, is it all about, you know, taking all of these matters to the courts, or is this about really keeping Trump voters engaged and pumped up?
You know, again, I really do think it's both. He is going to court. They are all of the people involved in this. It's not just, you know, Miller behind this organization. He's also got, you know, Matthew Whitaker, who is the acting attorney general under Trump, is part of this organization, as is former Trump chief of staff Mark Meadows and former Office of Management and Budget Director Russ Vought. So there's a lot of names behind here. They are definitely, you know, doing a lot of fundraising, asking for a lot of money and using these very divisive issues to try to engage Trump voters. But they are also going to court and trying to, you know, as they say it on their website, basically save America from the left.
And so what kind of cross-pollination are we seeing between Miller's cases and his cause here and the Trump fundraising machine?
No, I don't know exactly, because we don't have any insight into their financials. We know that when America First Legal Foundation first came, you know, launched their first press release was a quote from Trump praising Stephen Miller personally and saying what a great organization this is. So as far as what, you know, how much money they've raised and how it might compare to how much money Trump has raised, of course, huge amounts of money, it's really unclear. I spoke with some people who are very critical of America First Legal. Of course, there are people on the left who are opposed ideologically, but they say that Miller and these other folks are basically, you know, founded this to, you know, get as much money as possible from Trump supporters to sort of get a nice paycheck and wait for the next election when Republicans might, you know, somehow come back into power. So it's very, you know, cynical views are out there of what's going on here. But for as much money as they might be raising, like I said, they do seem to be doing quite a bit of work as well. They're not just focused on immigration by any stretch. They're going after everything from LGBT rights, transgender rights, in healthcare and employment, trying to remove protections there, and in filing all of these Freedom of Information Act requests, trying to expose what they think is wrongdoing related to everything from, you know, the closing down the investigation into the origins of COVID to alleged attempts to, you know, dismantle ICE. They're right. Kind of all over the place.
As you write, Eric, the group is also challenging pandemic aid that's earmarked for minority-owned firms. You spoke to a fourth-generation black farmer who's the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association, John Boyd. What is the group trying to do, and what does he say about Stephen Miller and his group's attempt to do it?
Well, you know, he was really offended. His organization intervened in Stephen Miller's lawsuit against the Biden administration, you know, in that huge pandemic relief bill. There were some large chunks of money earmarked for minority-owned restaurants, and another provision was for minority-owned farmers and ranchers. And Stephen Miller sued, saying that no money should be given. They shouldn't be given any preference based on race, that was literally discrimination, racial discrimination against white people is how he described it. And John Boyd, who's been part of this organization for so long, who founded it, he just said it was really offensive and said that there's just been this long history of government discrimination at the federal level and that Congress was just trying to do a little bit to right that wrong through some equity programs. And Stephen Miller sees those equity programs as kind of a dirty word. And he basically encouraged that Stephen Miller should live a day as a black man. He probably wouldn't hold these views, is what he said.
It's like Miller is like such the perfect boogeyman for the left, you know. And it's like I also can't imagine like a more perfect person to be kind of attempting to lead the Trump kind of legal machinations post presidency. It's just like everything you know about Trump in the courts is just like just. You know, muck it up and slow it down and make it painful. I guess we'll have to kind of see how some of these end up playing out. If there's a case to watch that sort of embodies what Miller's up to, what do you think that would be, Eric?
And Eric, really quickly, though.
Yep. The Texas abortion ban case, his group is now involved in that, representing some opponents to abortion. They're like interveners in the case. And he's I think he's going to be definitely trying to make his voice heard in that lawsuit as it progresses.
The world just gets more and more interesting. Joel Weber, thank you so much. Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek here in our Interactive Broker studio. Eric Larson, check out his story. He's U.S. legal reporter at Bloomberg News on the phone from Brooklyn. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, coming up, one of the most read stories on the Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Businessweek with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So this is one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg today. It's about a little notice change to Citigroup's rewards for top execs and how it has set off one of the bank's most prominent detractors.
Jenny Serain is joining us. She's finance reporter for Bloomberg News. She's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. So
we're in leather, looking pretty wild.
I'm check it out on YouTube.
Loving it. YouTube, you can see the leather jacket. I'm loving it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Jenny, what is this? What was this change in the regulatory filing? And why is Wells Fargo's Mike Mayo drawing attention to it?
Yeah, it was interesting because it was very little noticed. It came out on a quiet summer Friday.
Always does, right? Those little things.
So that was part of his concern. But I think his bigger concern was really just, you know, they're setting up a new bonus program for some of their new CEO, Jane Fraser's, her top deputies. So Paco Ibarra, he's their head of Institutional Clients Group, Chief Financial Officer Mike Mason, their head of Enterprise Ops and Tech, Mike Whitaker. They're all eligible for $5 million apiece over the next few years. If they can hit some targets around where the stock price goes and what Citi is doing to clean up the bank. But Wells Fargo's big issue with this is just that Citi didn't really disclose what those targets were. So there's, you know, a lot of specificity on the money at stake, but not a lot of specificity on the targets themselves. And so he's just calling fresh attention to this, saying they need to do better.
I got to read the quote. That's like my
favorite quote
from me. You guys all know what I'm going to read. Mike Mayo said in a note to clients, quote, "That's like charging us for dinner before we know if we're getting hot dogs or caviar."
Ouch. Yes. Well, and this is someone who's been a critic of Citi, correct?
Yes.
We all know Mike Mayo. The Bloomberg audience knows who he is. He was just on TV passing around popcorn. We'll talk about that later.
Yes. So he's very known for his very fiery exchanges with Citigroup executives for a long, long time now. Has been covering this stock for a while. You know, interestingly, he has, he's actually overweight on the stock. He's recommending that this is a buy. So, you know, there's, I think, a little bit of good and a little bit of bad here. He thinks there's a long way for this company to go, and he seems to believe that their new CEO, Jane Fraser, is a change agent that can accomplish that, but you know, still holding their feet to the fire on this.
Well, so help me out. I mean, this happens, right? I mean, a lot of firms, a lot of companies in general, publicly held companies, pick your industry, there are incentives that are given to senior execs to bring about XYZ at a company. Is it just that it came out late on a summer Friday? What is it that's so different or troubling?
I think just the fact that there's not a lot of disclosure around what these targets actually are. Like, what are you hoping your stock price will get to? What are they really responsible for in this turnaround at Citi? You know, it's important to remember Citi is in the middle of a years-long overhaul of all of their internal systems ordered by regulators late last year. This is a really important time for them, and it's important that they have their executives on board and that they have skin in the game in accomplishing that, but they need to be really clear, I think, with investors exactly what they're hoping to get out of this.
All right, two things. One would say, that's your job. Why do you need to be incented with a bonus to do it? Secondly, because you're such a great reporter, I'm assuming at some point you'd recently reached out to Citi about this and said, what's the deal? What are the metrics?
Yeah, so we reached out for comment. They declined. And I think, you know, we have an investor day set for next year where I think a lot more information will get shared about this. They just announced that it's going to be on March 2nd. So that's about a year after Jane took over. So we'll see. I think we're going to get more and more. But a lot of times with this regulatory stuff, you know, Citi's hands are really tied in terms of what they can actually say. Their regulators keep it very, very tightly controlled. So I do, you know, have a little bit of sympathy for them on the one hand, but on the other hand, we're journalists. We like a lot of transparency. So I think there's a little bit of a balancing work that Citi has to do here. And you know, Mike Mayo is just saying they've come out on the wrong side on this one.
Well, characterize for us, Jenny, what the challenges the bank has faced in recent years and what Fraser is trying to do.
Yeah, so the consent orders that they got hit with last year were really about a lot of the underlying risk management and internal controls. And so that's the stuff that, you know, runs all of the kind of underlying operations and really everything the bank does with our data and all this stuff. So this is a big overhaul that's going to be in front of them. And they do need to have senior leadership buying in and really paying attention, never dropping the ball. And I think that's what they were trying to do with this program. And they've even said, you know, we're naming these three officers, but we're going to have this apply to a lot of our top executives. And that's what regulators actually wanted from them. You know, if you actually read the consent orders, they said, we want you to be making sure that you've got, you know, compensation programs that are tied to this effort. So I think, you know, we'll see a lot. We won't see a lot. But the bank has said they're very focused on this. And it's a years long process that's not going to be easy to solve.
I'm not fast enough, but I'm trying to look up Mark Mason, who's the chief financial officer at Citigroup, just quickly, kind of what his compensation is. And I mean, he's already making $5.9 million in cash, $6.1 million in non-cash. It's a pretty nice salary, and I know people.
I wouldn't say no to it.
No, and I know folks on Wall Street get paid a lot of money, but some, again, going back to the argument, that's your job to make sure the right system's in place. Why do we need to layer something on top to make sure that those systems, the right systems, are in place? And forgive me, I don't mean to single out Mark. That's the page I pulled up on the Bloomberg.
Yeah. Well, and you know, Mike Mayo over at Wells, the other thing that he kept saying was, some of these executives were in charge of these businesses when a lot of these, you know, misdeeds were happening. So the idea that they're going to get more money to fix and clean up what maybe they were overseeing when there was the problem, that's a little hard to square away. But I do think, you know, the great resignation and this whole idea of lots of shifting folks moving around to different banks, they've got to keep the talent that they have. They need to have these folks clear-headed and kind of really focused on the task at hand.
And money does that, right?
And money definitely does that, I think. So, I mean, I think, you know, the prospect that, like, your bank could just continue to get hit with mean regulatory
Mike Mayo's in my right ear, and he's, like, feeding me these lies. Yeah, no, he's not.
I love that. But, I mean, I think Mike's points are good ones. Yeah. I think we'll see a lot from this bank over the next few months as they kind of finish up the initial reports that they owe to regulators. But it's definitely a big time at Citi. They've got a lot of work that has to be done.
Well, Jenny, just in the last 30 seconds that we have with you, Citi reporting earnings 8 a.m. on Thursday.
Yes.
What do you keep an eye on?
I mean, I think loan growth, that's the big thing we're looking at for all of these banks. Is it coming back yet? Are people borrowing on their credit cards? Are corporations getting back to this? I mean, I don't know that we'll see that this quarter, but I think everybody's going to be listening to these executives. You know, will they see it this year? Is this a next year thing? When does that come back?
If it's low, those numbers, those loan growth, does it say something about the economic outlook, the market, or does it just say that banks are just being incredibly picky still?
I think it's a lot more about the demand side. I think, okay, you know, folks are flush with cash after all this government aid. And so I think it's a lot more about demand at this point, or at least that's what the banks keep saying to us.
So good. In leather. I'm just saying. I'm kind of loving the whole package. Jenny Serain, she's a must read here at Bloomberg. And this is, as we mentioned, one of our most read stories on the Bloomberg. Jenny is finance reporter here at Bloomberg News.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's going to drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Charlie Pellett really summing up well. We're seeing some selling into the close, although, again, we are bottoming out here, but we are near our lows of the session here on the equity trade. Let's get to it with Alan Zaffron. He's founding partner and co-CEO, at IEQ Capital. He's on the phone in Foster City, California. Alan, nice to have you back here on Bloomberg Radio. So we're watching this market trade. It's going to be a big week for earnings. What's of interest to you when you look at kind of the churning that's going on? Because it's almost an even split if I look at the S&P 500. A little bit more selling when you look at the names that are losing ground today versus gaining ground.
Carol and Tim, thanks for having me on. I'm glad I'm the chief of many things, apparently.
Sorry. Did I add some titles?
I love it. Give me all more.
Congratulations on your promotion.
Exactly. HR is knocking on the door. Alan,
I got, there's two, I think, major trends impacting the market. One is this question about, is inflation going to be transitory or here to stay? And that's an issue we can talk about, because if you have inflation, there's a worry rates get too high, and this whole market was built on rates. And then the second thing that's not being talked about, I just think you have intra-market leadership changing. And what really has happened, we just got through what I think is the early cycle of the economic recovery, and we're transitioning into what we call the mid-cycle. So if you think about it, you know, we had this horrible recession back in March of 2020 and all that horrific human loss and all the illnesses and everything. But coming out of it from a classic economic perspective, when you have an early cycle recovery, you get a combination of earnings growth and valuations going up. So multiples expanded and earnings expanded. And we're now kind of past all that. So in the early stages, your small caps do well, value does well. Now you're transitioning into this mid-cycle. And the mid-cycle means earnings growth rates are peaking. Valuations have peaked. So valuations are going to start going down, but you're still having earnings growth. and probably growth enough to beat the compression in multiples. And so what's happening is there's this battle, and typically you rotate from the small caps and value stocks towards the mid caps and, frankly, large caps. And you're now starting to look for companies that are going to grow regardless of economic sensitivity. So you get at, you get towards tech and healthcare. You get away from the small caps. You get away from the deep cyclical businesses. But it's a churn. And this is the ugly churning happening right in the middle of September and October when the world's always rough, right in the middle of a big debt fight and tax hikes. It's just kind of a combination of all this at once is really hard to fathom out. But if you take a step back, you either decide inflation's here to stay or it's transitory, and you decide we're in the middle of this transition into a longstanding bull, or, yeah, this is the end of the market, the bull market. I don't believe it. I'm in the first camp. We're transitioning into a mid-cycle. We're going to have some ups and downs until it's clear that inflation is transitory, and that might not be clear until the early part of next year.
What are the data that's telling you that, Alan?
Well, what's telling me that is if you kind of look at the stuff that's gobbling up the inflation data, a lot of it is these big, bulky for things that get stuck in on the ships on the ports. So it's new cars and used cars and rental cars and video and auto equipment and RVs and sporting equipment and furniture and housing appliances. And those kinds of things are going to work through the cycle. The question is, are you really seeing wage inflation that's permanently going to sit there? I don't think you're going to see that at all. I think you're going to see continued challenges, even in trying to hire people. I still think there's so much productivity growth and there's so much use of technology. I think people are still going to clamor for the good jobs, and we are going to be able ultimately to find people. And I think where there's the rapid wage gains, a lot of it has been in the low-paid group, the hospitality workers and leisure workers, where there's a real shortage. That's not really going to drive up economic inflation to the point of being problematic for the markets. So I think it's going to diminish when we get into the latter half of next year.
But the big question still out there is if we get some kind of, you know, fourth wave, another variant. I hate to be such a pessimist. It's not who I am. But, the pandemic, we thought there'd be a bounce back. We get vaccines and we'll all be back to normal. It's not such a straight line. We see that. If we continue to have some problems, certainly when it comes to variants or COVID, that, Alan, will continue to impact those supply chains. Maybe workers can't go back to help produce, you know, the necessary products that are in demand. And that, as a result, could keep that transitory inflation, maybe still transitory, but transitory a little bit longer.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But let's think about that from the stock market perspective. A market that is market capitalization weighted, meaning the companies that are largest move the markets the most, and those are all large cap tech companies that largely grow even in a pandemic driven world. So as bad as that's going to be, and it's going to continue to worsen all this socioeconomic divide, it's probably not going to be that devastating for the stock markets. The big cap large tech names that are growing aren't going to get that devastated. And so I think you're going to see a continuation of, at worst, a sluggish market. Sure, you can get brief dropbacks, but there's too much liquidity in the system. And I think it's inevitable that the inflation eventually mitigates away, and the risk asset prices in a world of low yields work their way higher. They just do. It's just going to be sloppy between now and when we have visibility. And that's probably 3 to 6 months out.
And I think many people would argue it's a stock picker's market. So just before we let you go in the last 45 seconds that we have, give us some ideas.
Well, again, I'm going to harp on the fact we've moved away into this mid-cycle. So I still think it's really early to look at. When you get to the end cycle, you look at utilities and consumer staples, you're way too early for that. And the flip side of that is the easy money's been made in the, you know, low-quality hotels and restaurants and deep cyclical businesses. So play in the middle. Look for mid-cap and large-cap growth, steady franchise names where there's real earnings growth. The valuations can be it's really GARP, growth at a reasonable price.
Right.
Stay away from the high flyers and stay away from the junk. Play it in the middle with strong franchises.
All right. Alan, thank you so much. Great to have you back with us. That's Alan Zafran, a man of many titles, and I was giving him a few more. He's founding partner and co-CEO at IEQ Capital, on the phone from Foster City, California. But I always love it. It's very thoughtful in terms of the research. He shares with us a ton of research, so I always feel like we go into this knowing a lot and learn so much more when he joins us.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.